Welcome, and thanks for joining us at Hangar 46, the Air and Space Power Centre's podcast for the Royal Australian Air Force. At Hangar 46, we discuss a range of topics from emerging air and space power challenges, international relations, technology, ethics, culture, and so much more. We have an impressive lineup of guests. I trust you'll find them informative, at times provocative, and most importantly, entertaining. If there's someone you think we should invite to Hangar 46 for a chat, please reach out and let us know. Find us online at Air and Space Power Centre. Thank you and enjoy the episode. Hello, I'm Group Captain Michael Sleeman, Director of the Air and Space Power Centre. Today's guest here at Hangar 46 has spent a lifetime in the national security area. He is an expert in African and Asian security issues, peace and stability operations, weapons of mass destruction, and US grand strategy and foreign policy decision making. He has a PhD from Michigan State University and has taught as faculty at the University of Zambia, the University of Zimbabwe, Vanderbilt University, Hofstra University, and he's now in his 25th and final year as a Professor of International Security Studies at the United States Air Force Air War College. Professor Stephen Burgess, it's great to see you again. Thanks for joining us at Hangar 46.
Thanks, Michael. Great to see you again.
Tell us a bit about your background. You have very broad experience, as I just mentioned, with your studies you've done, the time you've spent overseas, and how you've dedicated over 25 years teaching at the United States Air Force Air War College. What led you to pursue the career you've had?
Yes, so as an undergraduate, I was fascinated by international relations and non-Western history, and I then focused on African history. From there, I was also interested in going to actually teach in an African university. I went to the Institute of Social Studies in The Hague in the Netherlands, and then from there on to the University of Zambia. And so there, I was involved then in teaching about African development, and also then in the struggle against apartheid in South Africa. And so there I was. My interest in my studies have been focusing in on international relations, conflict, peace, and state stability, but also comparative politics. So it's not just Africa, but it's Africa compared to other countries in the world. So what about the difference between India and South Africa, for instance, or the difference between Indonesia and Brazil? So that's kind of the where I started. And then after I got my PhD, after doing research at in Zimbabwe, I was went on then to teach in both international relations and also then comparative politics, with emphasis then on international security. So from there, I was hired at the Air War College in 1999. And as really their Africa expert, but also we teach national security decision making, we teach global security, and I taught an elective on peace and stability operations. And my research was one in which I first focused on South Africa's weapons of mass destruction, but also then when I was in New York in the 1990s, teaching at Hofstra University, I did work then on research on the United Nations and the really transformative process then of going then from a Cold War institution that wasn't working to one which was really very actively involved in a whole range of peace and stability operations. And so that was my second book. And so there then I went on to, teach those various core courses, also taking a group to Africa every year. But then about 20 years ago, I started becoming interested also in the growing relationship between the United States and India. And so I've done a number of research visits there, published on U.S.-Indian relations. And then that's where I kind of also got involved, interested in the Quad, and also then in Asia and Southeast Asia and Australia. So for there, I went to my research grants and was able then to 2014, 10 years ago, do research in Malaysia, Philippines, and Singapore, and then 2016 here in Australia, Japan, and South Korea, and then again in 2019 in Vietnam, Philippines, and Indonesia. And then I have publications on basically the U.S. relations with those various countries, and then the problems then in the South China Sea, of again the challenges in the East China Sea and related issues. So it's great to come back here again and to, you know, really talk about the issues that I've learned about, and also having the great group of students that I'm able to bring out every year to see them going from very basically not knowing much about the region and about Australia to becoming quasi experts, and so that's quite gratifying.
And so, what brings you to Australia this time?
So, I was asked by my leadership that I would switch then from teaching African regional studies to teaching a course then on what they call Indo-Pacific regional studies. And the focus is on Australia's national security and the relationship with the United States and also Indonesia's. And so we're having two visits to those two countries. We're also then focused, as I say, on the South China Sea, on Taiwan, other issues that are quite current, and how the quite dramatic and challenging security situation can be dealt with now and going forward into the 2030s. So that's what brings us here. And so we've met with a variety of experts. We've had both military, economic, and think tanks. And so we've also been able to have a tour of the Blue Mountains to, again, learn about the environmental challenges, about also the Aboriginal people, and also, so those are some of the things that we've been accomplished thus far. So again, thanks again to Australia and to the Royal Australian Air Force and for having us and for us having such a wonderful and educational time.
So you've taught a vast number of senior officers both in America, across the world, and including here in Australia, such as the current Deputy Chief of Air Force, Air Vice Marshal Harvey Reynolds, who you met earlier this week. And you've been coming to Australia and the region for many years now. What's your assessment of Australia's strategic awareness and the depth of our relationship with the United States?
I'm struck then by that the strategic awareness is there and that it's growing. That, again, given the reorientation that you're currently going through, there is that growing awareness that Australia and the United States need to work together. And so I think that's quite encouraging. I was thinking there might be some, you know, awkwardness about the relationship, but I think from what I've heard, that I think the relationship is strong, and it can weather the various political storms that happen in the United States, and that, you know, that fundamentally it goes back to, again, as Warren McDonnell was saying, to May 1942, when the United States and Australia, you know, came together in the Battle of the Coral Sea to basically protect Australia. And so we're dealing with this similar problem set today about, okay, how do Australia and the United States and Japan work together? And so I think that there is that kind of strategic, you know, bonding now that will withstand some of the political problems that are out there in the United States and other countries.
You spent the first part of your career as an expert in Africa before moving into the Indo-Pacific region, and you briefly touched on it before, and you've just mentioned Australia, Japan, etc. in the region. What was the reason that you did make that switch to become more of an expert in the Indo-Pacific region rather than Africa?
So I think fundamentally it goes back to the events of 2009-2010, where you had incidents in the East China Sea, where Japan was being threatened with a non-shipment of rare earth minerals to Toyota and to other industries, and then also then to the incidents then around the Senkaku Islands, those sorts of things, and then also then the pivot to Asia that on the Obama administration in November 2011. Those were all things that kind of, you know, researchers in national security in the United States, a number of us say, okay, well, this is something we really need to focus on. This is again again a very dramatic challenge that the United States is facing, and so of great importance for the United States is are its allies and partners. And so the alliances and partnerships the United States is able to maintain and develop, I think, is quite amazing. Dozens of great allies and increasing numbers of partners and growing partnerships. And so those are some of the things that I wanted to look at in my research. And then how then where are things headed in terms of the region, and you know, where are these countries, where are they standing? What can the United States do to strengthen relations? What are some of the challenges that lie ahead? So those are all issues that were fascinating to me. And so it's, I think, why I think I started to focus on this region. And of course, as I say, starting with India 20 years ago, then that was also part of it, because then the Quad in 2007, that was the first instance of the Quad. And now we have the Quad is a reality.
And there are many challenges that we do face. One of them is in the Red Sea. Are you able to explain the situation in the Red Sea at the moment?
So the Red Sea is connected then to the situation in Gaza right now. The Israeli and attempt to then to eliminate Hamas and the massive humanitarian disaster that's happening in Gaza. The Houthis then being pro-Iranian but also pro-Palestinian are using the Red Sea to target ships then that they think then are in some ways aiding or abetting Israel. And so that's why then you find that the number of ships that are being targeted and actually some actually being, attacked. And it's a way then of them protesting the situation in Gaza. And at the same time, also then sending the signal to the United States and its allies about, again, that their position and the Iranian position need to be taken seriously. And so that's why it's happening. And obviously, we know it's been a huge disruption to international shipping. Most of the shipping's now going around the Cape of Good Hope. And so that's,
And Australia's recently undertaken a defence strategic review, which called for a more focused force and much greater emphasis on our region, so Indo-Pacific rather than in the Middle East, around Africa, etc. What's your view on Australia's contribution to the US-led operations in the Red Sea?
Yeah, I think, again, it's appropriate given what Australia's new strategic direction. There has been some assistance that has been rendered, but Australia, from what we've learned here, needs to focus, and it doesn't need to be distracted, again, by the Middle East. Using resources and large amounts of resources in the Middle East is no longer really in Australia's security interests. That the focus needs to be then on the Indo-Pacific and developing the capabilities to actually achieve what Australia wants to do in this region. And so, it's hard for the United States to remain focused. The United States has, over the last 13 years, has been trying then to focus on the Indo-Pacific, but getting pulled back to the Middle East. And obviously now with the war in Ukraine, is focused back on Europe again. But for Australia, with being a much smaller force, it's really essential then for them not to get distracted and to focus on what the strategy basically is telling Australia to do.
Regarding the Africa, where you have great expertise, where do you see any other potential conflicts in that region, whether it be fighting conflicts or resource extraction that might have follow-on effects for national security? Are there any areas in those topics that are of particular concern or note to you?
Yeah, I've been doing research for almost 15 years now on critical minerals. That's another area. And so in Africa, the focus of my research was on rare earth minerals, cobalt, platinum group metals, and so the countries that are of utmost importance there are like Democratic Republic of Congo, South Africa, and Zambia, Zimbabwe. And so those countries and competition that's going on now over those minerals and whether the West, the G7 countries and others will be able to have access to those, or whether the resources will be monopolized. And it's also then an issue of, in this region, again, of, okay, how, now that we're moving to green energy, how does the countries that and the industries that need those resources, how are they going to continue to access them? Is it going to be a strategic problem given the tensions that are in this region? And so what can be done then to find, alternative sources? What can be done to work with governments to provide greater assistance in building transparency and accountability so that that free market principles can apply? How do you also generate industries that may benefit the green energy in the long term, but may harm the environment in the short term? So those are all issues that I'm interested in.
Moving on to Asia, the pivot to Asia that you've done and that the U.S. administration did under Obama. First of all, before we get into some details in there, what's your overall assessment of the strategic environment and how that's changing in the Indo-Pacific region?
I think it's challenging. The last 4 years, especially since COVID, but even before that, over the last decade, the challenge has gotten stronger and stronger, and the relationship, the relations here have become more strained. And so, and the challenges then of defending Taiwan, of having free freedom of navigation in the South China Sea, those sorts of issues of also then maintaining influence and also free market activities then in the region, it's become more and more challenging. And the military challenges are especially challenging. They're especially, again, becoming more and more severe. And so the prospects of conflict could mean massive, catastrophic losses. And so those are some of the things that, kind of focus the mind that this is not the Middle East. This is a situation which, if things are not done properly, if there's not proper diplomacy, if there's not proper communication, that things could get out of hand, and we could find a very devastating conflict.
Historically, many conflicts have started as a result of accidents or miscalculations, as the world's first historian, Thucydides, has taught us. What's the greatest threat to peace in the region? Do you believe it's intentional hostile action or unintended escalation?
I think the great is intention on particular issues of and who controls what particular territory, that some countries want to, use force to, like Russia has done in Ukraine. That, I think, is the greatest challenge. Now, we could see then, like in the South China Sea, for instance, that the Philippines is trying to assert its interest. The United States is now backing the Philippines, that this could lead to an accident, and there could be a crisis. And I don't know if that, I don't think that crisis would escalate into war, but it is something that is of concern. You have to say, okay, how, and I think there are those in authority who want de-escalation, don't want an accident to escalate into a major war. And so that, I think, is a concern. It can be managed. The big problem is that the question of, like we see with the Russia and Ukraine, the violation of another country's sovereignty is something that could lead to a major war.
How do we reduce the likelihood of that major war, whether it's through intentional actions or miscalculations? What are some strategies we can employ to reduce the likelihood?
Obviously, as I said, communication is important, having open channels to exchange views. That's quite important. The other thing, though, is being able to increase your deterrence capability and credibility, so that you need to have increasing amounts of ability then to signal to the other side that you're getting stronger and that you're willing to use force as necessary, and that you're willing to pay certain levels of cost. And so that I think those are things that have to, continue to increase given the challenge, because the other side is continuing to increase its capability. And so that's why it's encouraging that Australia is in AUKUS, and it's encouraging that Australia has the F-35 program, and working closely with the United States to increase its deterrence capability in northern bases in Australia. Those are all things that are necessary to continue to increase deterrence capability.
If that deterrence fails, do you believe there are sufficient off-ramps or de-escalation points for the United States, for example, should the tension start to rise? Do we have those built into our current system, or is there something else we need to be doing, do you believe?
Yes, they're built in, but again, it's when the crisis occurs, then you see, is de-escalation actually working? Do we need to try something different if it's not? The greatest plans for de-escalation and for a strategy, then often when it hits reality, then it becomes necessary to adjust. But given a major conflict, an invasion or a blockade, then it becomes trickier, because then you're going into in a warlike scenario, and so interests are very high on both sides, and so de-escalation then becomes even more difficult.
Moving on to the studies and the what you do at Maxwell Air Force Base. So I studied under you and your wife, Janet, back in 2017. Since then, I note the curriculum taught at the War College in the United States has undergone significant change. Can you talk us through some of these changes?
Yes. So the last 2 years, we have shifted to teaching great power studies. And so we focus on the three great powers and the one power in this region in particular. And so that is a dramatic shift. And previously, that was not. It was just part of the curriculum. But now it's the focus of the curriculum. And at the same time, we've also added in war gaming quite intensively in three different times of the year. And so that is quite different from what we used to do, which is in Air War College we focused on national security decision making, knowing the inner workings of government and of the national security strategy. Now it's more again knowing how do you apply your national security strategy, national defense strategy, to the challenges of the two great adversarial powers that the United States is facing. So that is quite a big change. And I think also it focuses the mind of the students to say now they know that what is coming down the road could be a major catastrophe in their careers, given the possibility of war. And so that I think that is there. So I think that not only the curriculum has changed, but I think the seriousness then of the students has also changed. But again, they could probably be even greater attention. And it's come down from the Department of Defense, from the Air Force leadership, has all come down to say, well, this, you continue to get these apocalyptic messages or whatever from the leadership. And so we did pivot very quickly. And again, we were, Air War College, Air Command Staff College, were ahead of the other colleges in terms of making this transition.
And is that something you've noted, the seriousness that military officers or the government are taking the potential for great power conflict? Is that been a marked change that you've noticed in your time at the college?
Yeah, and so it has. And so starting with the 2017 National Security Strategy and the 2018 National Defense Strategy, that again was... Even before that, there was, again, within the Department of Defense, there was emphasis on trying to switch focus and trying to become more serious. And so, but since then, that it's been building. When I got to the Air War College in 1999, we were really in, peacetime American primacy, and so the level of seriousness was low. September 11th, obviously, created a new focus and a new seriousness, and that we focused then on on culture and other things in the Middle East. But now, I guess, the focus has shifted again, and we're being called upon, and the students are being called upon to basically raise their game.
One of those moments that have happened is Ukraine conflict, the Russian invasion of Ukraine, which I'm sure has focused the mind a bit as well. How do you see the future, maybe the next 6-12 months, playing out in Ukraine?
I think, again, it's Ukraine's going to hold on, that the Russians readjusted their strategy and are willing then to basically do what Stalin and the Soviet Union did during 1943, 1944, which is grind the Germans down. And here the Russians are grinding the Ukrainians down. So they obviously have huge advantages in artillery and armor and a willingness then to sacrifice soldiers. So Ukraine obviously has made great strides in terms of using autonomous warfare, of using cyber, using long-range strike, those sorts of things that they need. Again, a continued support then from the United States and Europe in order to survive. And so if they can hang on this year and they get the U.S. finally passes the bill to provide $60 billion to Ukraine, then there's hope that in 2025, then finally, you know, Putin will realize that he's running out of resources, that ultimately there has to be some sort of peace deal. But I think, you know, given what happened back in the summer of 2023, the Ukrainian counteroffensive failed. And so we know then that it's going to be very hard for Ukraine to get back all of its territory, and that a peace agreement in 2025 or 2026 is going to be one in which, you know, unfortunately, Russia will continue to hold, you know, the significant part of Ukrainian territory.
In terms of you mentioned autonomy, the use of drones, etc. What lessons can the West, the United States, Australia, learn from the way that the Ukrainian forces have adapted and innovated new systems that have come about because of the conflict? What lessons are there we can learn?
Yeah, so again, using large amounts of autonomous vehicles and also weapons, then also with artificial intelligence, you can have greater level of operational force and also then of operational awareness. And so those are attributes that are really getting coming from Ukraine. For Australia and for the United States in this theater, obviously it's very different because you're dealing with vast distances. You're dealing with, the need then to try to marry autonomous systems with crewed systems. So the Ukrainian example is one, yes, that it's a really, it's a great force multiplier. Then it has to be adapted to the Indo-Pacific region.
Yeah, I think that is one thing we can't lose sight of, the fact that there are lessons to learn, but we need to apply them to our context and our environment with the distances that you mentioned. Mm-hmm. Finally, again, back to you. So you're about to retire after a fair innings at the crease. Sorry to use mm-hmm. a cricket reference. What lies ahead for you and Janet in retirement?
Right. I love cricket, by the way. And congratulations to Australia and again being world champions again. We've bought a house in Gainesville, Florida, where the University of Florida is located. They have a great African Studies Center, great International Studies Center, and it's a very culturally rich city, university city. Both going to be very much involved in continuing our interests in African studies and European studies and Asian studies, and meeting and developing relationships with both faculty colleagues and with students, and doing a bit of mentoring. And whatever else comes along, but we're very much looking forward to it. I could continue to do what I've been doing at the Air War College for another decade, but I think now is the time to step away and try something different.
So not really retirement, just semi-retirement with a bunch of new jobs to do in Florida.
Yeah, you can never retire. You know, you always have to continue to pursue your interests. You can't just sit back and sit on the beach all day. No, you can't. You have to continue to strive to build yourself and your interests and have a life then that continues to be stimulating. You cannot allow yourself to sit back and atrophy.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure, Doc, seeing you again over this week and sitting down with you today and just picking your brain with all that knowledge you have in Africa, in Europe, in Australia, in the region. So thanks very much for your time. It's been a pleasure having you here at Hangar 46.
Thanks, Mike. It's great to be with you.
Thanks for joining us at Hangar 46. We'll be back again soon for another chat. But in the meantime, follow us online at Air and Space Power Centre to stay up to date.